hostility which inevitably grow amongst those who refuse to become enemies. But they don't want the company. And my splendid glass-walled drawing rooms on the Night Island were soon empty, and I myself had long before that started to wander for weeks, even months on my own. It is still there, the Night Island. It is there, and now and then I do go back, and I find there some lone immortal who has checked in, as we say in the modern age, to see how it goes with the rest of us, or with some other who might be visiting as well. The great enterprise I sold for a mortal fortune, but I maintain my ownership of the four-story villa, a private club named Il Villaggio, with its deep secret underground crypts to which all of our kind are welcome to come. All of our kind. There are not so many. But let me tell you now who they were. Let me tell you now who has survived the centuries, who has resurfaced after hundreds of years of mysterious absence, who has come forward to be counted in the unwritten census of the modern living dead. There is Lestat, first and foremost, the author of four books of his life and his adventures, comprising everything you could ever possibly want to know about him, and some of us. Lestat, ever the maverick and the laughing trickster, 6 feet tall, a young man of 20 when made, with huge warm blue eyes and thick flashy blonde hair, square of jaw, with a generous, beautifully shaped mouth, and skin darkened by a sojourn in the sun, which would have killed a weaker vampire. A ladies' man, an Oscar Wildean fantasy, the glass of fashion, the most bold and disregarding dusty vagabond on occasion, loner, wanderer, heartbreaker, and wise guy, dubbed the Brat Prince by my old master. Yes, imagine it, my Marius. Yes, my Marius, who did indeed survive the torches of the Roman coven. Dubbed by Marius the Brat Prince, though in whose court and by whose divine right and whose royal blood, I should like to know. Lestat, stuffed with the blood of the most ancient of our kind, indeed the very blood of the Eve of our species, some 5 to 7,000 years the survivor of her Eden, a perfect horror who, emerging from the deceptive poetical title of Queen Akasha of Those Who Must Be Kept, almost destroyed the world. Lestat, not a bad friend to have, and one for whom I would lay down my immortal life, one for whose love and companionship I have oft-times begged, one whom I find maddening and fascinating and intolerably annoying, one without whom I cannot exist. So much for him. Louis de Poindulac, already described above, but always fun to envisage. Slender, slightly less tall than Lestat, his maker, black of hair, gaunt and white of skin, with amazingly long and delicate fingers, and feet that do not make a sound. Louis, whose green eyes are soulful, the very mirror of patient misery, soft-voiced, very human, weak, having lived only 200 years, unable to read minds, or to levitate, or to spellbind others except inadvertently, which can be hilarious, an immortal with whom mortals fall in love. Louis, an indiscriminate killer, because he cannot satisfy his thirst without killing, though he is too weak to risk the death of the victim in his arms, and because he has no pride or vanity which would lead him to a hierarchy of intended victims, and therefore takes those who cross his path, regardless of age, physical endowments, or blessings bestowed by nature or fate. Louis, a deadly and romantic vampire, the kind of night creature who hovers in the deep shadows at the opera house to listen to Mozart's Queen of the Night give forth her piercing and irresistible song. Louis, who has never vanished, who has always been known to others, who is easy to track and easy to abandon. Louis, who will not make others after his tragic blunder with vampiric children. Louis, who is past questing for God, for the devil, for truth, or even for love. Sweet, dusty Louis, reading Keats by the light of one candle. Louis, standing in the rain on a slick, deserted downtown street, watching through the store window the brilliant young actor Leonardo DiCaprio as Shakespeare's Romeo, kissing his tender and lovely Juliet, Claire Danes, on a television screen. Gabrielle, she's around now. She was around on the Night Island. Everyone hates her. She is Lestat's mother, and abandons him for centuries, and somehow doesn't manage to heed Lestat's periodic and inevitable frantic cries for help, which, though she could not receive them, being his fledgling, could certainly learn of them from other vampiric minds, which are on fire with the news round the world when Lestat is in trouble. Gabrielle, she looks just like him, except she's a woman, totally a woman, that is, sharper of feature, small-waisted, big-breasted, sweet-eyed in the most unnerving and dishonest fashion, gorgeous in a black ball gown with her hair free, more often dusty, genderless, sheathed in supple leather or belted khaki, a steady walker, and a vampire so cunning and cold that she has forgotten what it ever meant to be human or in pain. Indeed, I think she forgot overnight, if she ever knew it. She was in mortal life one of those creatures who always wondered what the others were carrying on about. Gabrielle, low-voiced, unintentionally vicious, glacial, forbidding, ungiving, a wanderer through snowy forests of the far north, a slayer of giant white bears and white tigers, an indifferent legend to untamed tribes, something more akin to a prehistoric reptile than a human. Beautiful, naturally, blonde hair in a braid down her back, almost regal in a chocolate-colored leather safari jacket and a small, droopy, brimmed rain hat, a stalker, a quick killer, a pitiless and seemingly thoughtful but eternally secretive thing. Gabrielle, virtually useless to anyone but herself. Some night she'll say something to someone, I suppose. Pandora, child of two millennia, consort to my own beloved Marius, 1,000 years before I was ever born. A goddess, made of bleeding marble, a powerful beauty out of the deepest and most ancient soul of Roman Italy, fierce with the moral fiber of the old senatorial class of the greatest empire the Western world has ever known. I don't know her. Her oval face shimmers beneath a mantle of rippling brown hair. She seems too beautiful to hurt anyone. She is tender-voiced, with innocent, imploring eyes, her flawless face instantly vulnerable and warm with empathy, a mystery. I don't know how Marius could ever have left her. In a short shift of filmy silk, with a snake bracelet on her bare arm, she is too ravishing for mortal males, and the envy of females. In her longer, concealing gowns, she moves as a wraith through the rooms around her, as if they are not real to her, and she, the ghost of a dancer, seeks for some perfect setting that she alone can find. Her powers certainly rival those of Marius. She is drunk from the Eden fount, that is, the blood of Queen Akasha. She can kindle crisp, dry objects into fire with the power of her mind, levitate and vanish in the dark sky, slay the young blood drinkers if they menace her, and yet she seems harmless, forever feminine, though indifferent to gender, a wan and plaintive woman whom I want to close in my arms. Santino, the old saint of Rome. He has wandered into the disasters of the modern era with all his beauty unblemished. Still the big-shouldered, strong-chested one, olive skin paler now with the workings of the fierce, magical blood, huge head of black curling hair, often clipped each night at sunset, for the sake of anonymity, perhaps, unvain, perfectly dressed in black. He says nothing to anyone. He looks at me silently, as if we never talked together of theology and mysticism, as if he never broke my happiness, burnt my youth to cinders, drove my maker into century-long convalescence, divided me from all comfort. Perhaps he fancies us as fellow victims of a powerful intellectual morality, an infatuation with the concept of purpose, two lost ones, veterans of the same war. At times he looks shrewd and even hateful. He knows plenty. He doesn't underestimate the powers of the ancient ones, who, eschewing the social invisibility of centuries past, now walk among us with perfect ease. When he looks at me, his black eyes are unflinching and passive. The shadow of his beard, fixed forever into the tiny, cut-off dark hairs embedded in his skin, is beautiful as it always was. He is all in all conventionally virile, crisp white shirt open at the throat to show the portion of the thick, curly black hair that covers his chest, a similar enticing black fleece covering the visible flesh of his arms at the wrists. He favors sleek but sturdy black coats, lapelled in leather or fur, low-slung black cars that move at 200 miles an hour, a golden cigarette lighter reeking of combustible fluid, which he lights over and over again just to peer into the flame. Where he actually lives and when he will surface, nobody knows. Santino, I know no more about him than that. We keep a gentlemanly distance from one another. I suspect his own suffering has been terrible. I do not seek to break the shiny, black, fashionable carapace of his demeanor to discover some raw, bloody tragedy beneath it. To know Santino, there is always time. Now let me describe for the most virginal of readers my master, Marius, as he is now. So much time and experience divide us now that it is like a glacier between us, and we stare at each other across the glowing whiteness of that impassable waste, able only to speak in lulled and polite voices, so mannerly, the young creature I appear to be, too sweet-faced for casual belief, and he, ever the worldly sophisticate, the scholar of the moment, the philosopher of the century, ethicist of the millennium, historian for all time. He walks tall, as he always did, imperial still in his subdued 20th-century fashion, carving his coats out of old velvet that they may give some faint clue of the magnificence that was once his knightly dress. On occasions now he clips the long flowing yellow hair which he wore so proudly in old Venice. He is ever quick of wit and tongue, and eager for reasonable solutions, possessed of infinite patience and unquenchable curiosity, and a refusal to give up on the fate of himself, or of us, or of this world. No knowledge can defeat him. Tempered by fire and time, he is too strong for the horrors of technology or the spells of science. Neither microscopes nor computers shake his faith in the infinite. Though his once solemn charges, those who must be kept, who held such promise of redemptive meaning, have long been toppled from their archaic thrones. I fear him. I don't know why. Perhaps I fear him because I could love him again, and loving him I would come to need him, and needing him I would come to learn from him, and learning from him I would be again his faithful pupil in all things, only to discover that his patience for me is no substitute for the passion which long ago blazed in his eyes. I need that passion. I need it. But enough of him. 2,000 years he had survived, slipping in and out of the very mainstream of human life without compunction, a great practitioner of the art of being human, carrying with him forever the grace and quiet dignity of the Augustan age, of seemingly invincible Rome, in which he was born. There are others who are not here now with me, though they have been on the Night Island, and I will see them again. There are the ancient twins, Macare and Maharet, custodians of the primal blood fount from which our life flows, the roots of the vine, so to speak, upon which we so stubbornly and beautifully bloom. They are our queens of the damned. Then there is Jesse Reeves, a 20th-century fledgling made by Maharet, the very eldest, and therefore a dazzling monster, unknown to me but greatly admired. Bringing with her into the world of the undead an incomparable education in history, the paranormal, philosophy, and languages, she is the unknown. Will the fire consume her, as it has so many others who, weary of life, cannot accept immortality? Or will her 20th-century wit give her some radical and indestructible armor for the inconceivable changes that we now know must lie ahead? Ah, there are others. There are wanderers. I can hear their voices from time to time in the night. There are those far away who know nothing of our traditions, and have styled us, in hostility to our writings and in amusement at our antics, the coven of the articulate, strange, unregistered beings of various ages, strengths, attitudes, who sometimes, seeing on a paperback rack a copy of The Vampire Lestat, tear it loose and grind the small book to powder within their powerful and scornful hands. They may lend their wisdom or their wit to our unfolding chronicle in some unpredictable future. Who knows? For now, there is but one more player who must be described before my tale can be advanced. That one is you, David Talbot, whom I scarcely know. You, who write with furious speed all the words that come slowly tumbling from me, as I watch you, mesmerized on some level by the mere fact that these sentiments, so long allowed to burn inside of me, are now recorded on the seemingly eternal page. What are you, David Talbot? Over 7 decades old in mortal education, a scholar, a deep and loving soul, how can one tell? That which you were in life, wise in years, strengthened by routine calamity, and deepened by the full 4 seasons of a man's span upon the earth, was transported with all memory and learning intact into the splendid body of a younger man. And then that body, a precious chalice for the grail of your very self, who knew so well the value of both elements, was then assaulted by your closest of friends, the loving monster, the vampire who would have you as his fellow traveler in eternity, whether or not you gave him leave, our beloved Lestat. I cannot imagine such a rape. I stand too far from all humanity, never having been a full man. In your face I see the vigor and beauty of the dark, golden-skinned Anglo-Hindi whose body you enjoy, and in your eyes the calm and dangerously well-tempered soul of the old man. Your hair is black and soft, and handily trimmed below your ears. You dress with high vanity, submitted to a staunch British sense of style. You look at me as though your curiosity will put me off guard, when nothing of the sort is true. Hurt me and I'll destroy you. I don't care how strong you are, or what blood Lestat gave you. I know more than you do. Because I show you my pain, I do not of necessity love you. I do this for myself and for others, for the very idea of others, for any who would know, and for my mortals. Those two I've gathered to me so recently. Those two precious ones who have become the ticking clock of my capacity to go on. Symphony for Cybele, that might as well be the name of this confession. And having done my best for Cybele, I do my best for you as well. Is that not enough of the past? Is that not enough prologue to the moment in New York when I saw Christ's face in the veil? There begins the final chapter of my life of late. There is nothing more to it. You have all the rest. And what must needs come now is but the brief, harrowing account of what has brought me here. Be my friend, David. I didn't mean to say such terrible things to you. My heart aches. I need you just to tell me that I may rush on. Help me with your experience. Isn't this enough? May I go on? I want to hear Cybele's music. I want to talk of beloved rescuers. I can't measure the proportions of this story. I only know I am ready. I have reached the far side of the Bridge of Sighs. Ah, but it's my decision, yes, and you wait to write what I will say. Well, let me go now to the veil. Let me go now to the face of Christ, as if I were walking uphill in the long-ago snowy winter in Podol, beneath the broken towers of Vladimir's city, to seek within the monastery of the caves the paint and the wood on which to see it take form before me. His face, Christ, yes, the Redeemer, the living Lord once more. Part 3. Appassionata. Chapter 17. I didn't want to go to him. It was winter, and I was contented in London, haunting the theatres to see the plays of Shakespeare, and reading the plays and the sonnets the whole night long. I had no other thoughts just now but Shakespeare. Lestat had given him to me, and when I'd had a bellyful of despair, I'd opened the books and begun to read. But Lestat was calling. Lestat was, or so he claimed, afraid. I had to go. The last time he'd been in trouble, I hadn't been free to rush to his rescue. There is a story to that, but nothing as important as this one which I tell now. Now I knew that my hard-won peace of mind might be shattered by the mere contact with him, but he wanted me to come, so I went. I found him first in New York, though he didn't know it, and he couldn't have led me into a worse snowstorm if he'd tried. He slew a mortal that night, a victim with whom he'd fallen in love, as was his custom of late, to pick these celebrities of high crimes and horrid murders, and to stalk them before the night of the feast. So what did he want of me, I wondered. You were there, David. You could help him. Or so it seemed. Being his fledgling, you hadn't heard his call directly, but he'd reached you somehow, and the two of you, such proper gentlemen, came together to discuss in low, sophisticated whispers Lestat's latest fears. When next I caught up with him, he was in New Orleans, and he put it to me plain and simple. You were there. The devil had come to him in the guise of a man. The devil could change shapes, being at one moment horrific and ghastly, with webbed wings and hoofed feet, and then, next, the devil could be an ordinary man. Lestat was wild with these stories. The devil had offered him a dreadful proposition, that he, Lestat, become the devil's helper in the service of God. Do you remember how calmly I responded to his story, his questions, his pleading for our advice? Oh, I told him firmly it was madness to follow this spirit, to believe that any discarnate thing was bound to tell him the truth. But only now do you know the wounds he opened with this strange and marvelous fable. So the devil would make him a hellish helper, and thereby a servant of God? I might have laughed outright, or wept, throwing it in his face that I had once believed myself a saint of evil, shivering in rags as I stalked my victims in the Parisian winter, all for the honor and glory of God. But he knew all this. There was no need to wound him further, to shift from him the limelight of his own tale, which Lestat, being the bright star, must always have. Under moss-hung oaks we talked in civilized voices. You and I begged him to be cautious. Naturally, he ignored all we said. It was all mixed up with the entrancing mortal Dora, who was living then in this very building, this old brick convent, the daughter of the man Lestat had stalked and slain. When he bound us to look out for her, I was angry, but only mildly so. I have fallen in love with mortals. I have those tales to tell. I am in love now with Cybele and Benjamin, whom I call my children, and I had been a secret troubadour to other mortals in the dim past. All right, he was in love with Dora. He'd laid his head on a mortal breast. He wanted the womb blood of her that would be no loss to her. He was smitten, crazed, goaded by the ghost of her father, and courted by the prince of evil himself. And she, what shall I say of her? That she possessed the power of a Rasputin behind the face of a nunnery postulant? When, in fact, she is a practiced theologian, and not a mystic, a ranting, raving leader, not a visionary whose ecclesiastical ambitions would have dwarfed those of Saints Peter and Paul put together, and that, of course, she is like any flower Lestat ever gathered from the savage garden of this world, a most fine and fetching little creature, a glorious specimen of God's creation, with raven hair, a pouty mouth, cheeks of porcelain, and the dashing limbs of a nymph. Of course, I knew the very moment that he left this world. I felt it. I was in New York already, very near to him, and aware that you were there as well. Neither of us meant to let him out of our sight, if at all possible. Then came the moment when he vanished in the blizzard, when he was sucked out of the earthly atmosphere as if he'd never been there. Being his fledgling, you couldn't hear the perfect silence that descended when he vanished. You couldn't know how completely he'd been withdrawn from all things minuscule yet material, which had once echoed with the beating of his heart. I knew, and I think it was to distract us both, that I proposed we go to the wounded mortal, who must have been shattered by her father's death at the hands of a blond-haired, handsome, blood-swilling monster, who'd made her his confidant and a friend. It was not difficult to help her in the short, event-filled nights that followed, when horror was heaped upon horror, her father's murder discovered, his sordid life at once made by media magic the madcap conversation of the wide world. It seems a century ago, not merely so short a time, that we moved south to these rooms, her father's legacy of crucifixes and statues, of icons which I handled so coolly, as if I'd never loved such treasures at all. It seems a century ago that I dressed decently for her, finding in some fashionable Fifth Avenue shop a shapely coat of old red velvet, a poet's shirt, as they call it now, of starched cotton and ample flopping lace. And to set this off, peg-leg trousers of black wool and shiny boots that buckled at the ankle, all this the better to accompany her to identify her father's severed head under the leeching fluorescent lights of some immense and overcrowded morgue. One good thing about this final decade of the 20th century is that a man of any age can wear his hair at any length. It seems a century ago that I combed out mine, full and curly and clean for once, just for her. It seems a century ago we stood so staunchly beside her, indeed, even held her, this long-necked, short-haired, spellbinding witchlet, in our very arms, as she wept over the death of her father, and pelted us with feverish and maniacally intelligent and dispassionate questions about our sinister nature, as if a great crash course in the anatomy of the vampire could somehow close the cycle of horror threatening her wholesomeness and her sanity, and somehow bring her wicked, conscienceless father back. No, it wasn't the return of Roger, actually, that she prayed for. She believed too totally in the omniscience and mercy of God. Besides, seeing a man's severed head is a bit of a shock, even if the head is frozen. And a dog had chomped on Roger a bit before he'd been discovered. And what with the strict no-touch rules of modern forensics, he was, for me even, quite a sight. I remember the coroner's assistant saying soulfully to me that I was awfully young to have to see such a thing. She thought I was Dora's little brother. What a sweet woman she was. Perhaps it's worth it to make a foray into the official mortal world once in a while in order to be called a real trooper instead of a Botticelli angel, which has become my tagline among the undead. It was the return of Lestat Dora dreamed of. What else would ever allow her to break free of our enchantment but some final blessing from the crowned prince himself? I stood at the dark glass windows of the high-rise apartment, looking out over the deep snows of Fifth Avenue, waiting and praying with her, wishing the great earth were not so empty of my old enemy, and thinking in my foolish heart that in time this mystery of his disappearance would be resolved, as were all miracles, with sadness and small losses, with no more than little revelations that would leave me as I had always been left, since that long-ago night in Venice when my master and I were divided forever, simply a little more clever at pretending that I was still alive. I didn't fear for Lestat, not really. I had no hopes for his adventure, except that he would appear sooner or later and tell us some fantastical yarn. It would be regular Lestat talk, for nobody aggrandizes as he does his preposterous adventures. That is not to say that he hasn't switched bodies with a human. I know that he has. That is not to say that he didn't wake our fearsome goddess mother, Akasha. I know that he did. This is not to say that he didn't smash my old superstitious coven to bits and pieces in the garish years before the French Revolution. I've already told you so. But it's the way he describes things that happened to him that maddens me, the way that he connects one incident to another, as though all these random and grisly occurrences were in fact links in some significant chain. They are not. They are capers, and he knows it. But he must make a gutter theatrical out of stubbing his toe. The James Bond of the vampires, the Sam Spade of his own pages, a rock singer wailing on a mortal stage for all of 2 hours, and, on the strength of that, retiring with a slew of recordings that feed him filthy lucre still from human agencies to this very night. He has a knack for making tragedy of tribulation, and forgiving himself for anything and everything in every confessional paragraph he pens. I can't fault him, really. I cannot help but hate it that he lies now in a coma on the floor of his chapel here, staring into a self-contained silence, despite the fledglings that circle him, for precisely the same reason as I did, to see for themselves if the blood of Christ has transformed him somehow, and he does not represent some magnificent manifestation of the miracle of the transubstantiation. But I'll come to that soon enough. I've ranted myself into a little corner. I know why I resent him so, and find it so soothing to hammer at his reputation, to beat upon his immensity with both my fists. He has taught me too much. He has brought me to this very moment here, where I stand dictating to you my past with a coherence and calm that would have been impossible before I came to his assistance with his precious Memnoch the Devil and his vulnerable little Dora. 200 years ago, he stripped me of illusions, lies, excuses, and thrust me on the Paris pavements naked to find my way back to a glory in the starlight that I had once known and too painfully lost. But as we waited finally in the handsome high-rise apartment above St. Patrick's Cathedral, I had no idea how much more he could strip from me, and I hate him only because I cannot imagine my soul without him now, and, owing him all that I am and know, I can do nothing to make him wake from his frigid sleep. But let me take things one at a time, What good is it to go back down now to the chapel here and lay my hands on him again and beg him to listen to me, when he lies as though all sense has truly left him and will never return? I can't accept this. I won't. I've lost all patience. I've lost the numbness that was my consolation. I find this moment intolerable. But I have to tell you things. I have to tell you what happened when I saw the veil, and when the sun struck me, and, more wretchedly for me, what I saw when finally I reached Lestat and drew so close to him that I could drink his blood. Yes, stay on course. I know now why he makes the chain. It isn't pride, is it? It's the necessity. The tale can't be told without one link being connected to the other, and we poor orphans of ticking time know no other means of measure but those of sequins. Dropped into the snowy blackness, into a world worse than a void, I reached for a chain, did I not? Oh God, what I would have given in that awful descent to grasp the firmness of a metal chain. He came back so suddenly, to you and Dora and me. It was the third morning, and not long enough before dawn. I heard the doors slam far below us in the glass tower, and then that sound which gains in eerie volume each year, the beating of his heart. Who was the first to rise from the table? I was still with fear. He came too fast, and there were those wild fragrances whirling about him of woodland and raw earth. He crashed through all barriers as if he were pursued by those who'd stolen him away, and yet there was no one behind him. He came alone into the apartment, slamming the door in his wake, and then standing before us, more horrible than I could ever have imagined, more ruined than I had ever seen him in any of his former little defeats. With absolute love, Dora ran to him, and in a desperate need that was all too human, he clutched at her so fiercely that I thought he would destroy her. "You're safe now, darling," she cried, struggling so as to make him understand. But we had only to look at him to know it wasn't finished, though we murmured the same hollow words in the face of what we beheld. Chapter 18. He had come from the maelstrom. One shoe was left to him, the other foot bare, his coat torn, his hair wild and snagged with thorns and dried leaves and bits of errant flowers. In his arms, to his chest, he clutched a flat bundle of folded cloth, as if it carried the whole fate of the world embroidered on it. But the worst, the very worst horror of all, was that one eye had been torn from his beautiful face, and the socket of vampiric lids puckered and shuddered, seeking to close, refusing to acknowledge this horrid disfigurement to the body rendered perfect for all time when he'd been made immortal. I wanted to take him in my arms. I wanted to comfort him, to tell him wherever he'd gone and whatever had taken place, he was now safe again with us. But nothing could quiet him. A deep exhaustion saved us all from the inevitable tale. We had to seek our dark corners away from the prying sun. We had to wait until the following night, when he would come out to us and tell us what had happened. Still clutching the bundle, refusing all help, he closeted himself up with his wound. I had no choice but to leave him. As I sank down that morning into my own resting place, secure in clean modern darkness, I cried and cried like a child on account of the sight of him. Oh, why had I come to his aid? Why must I see him brought low like this, when it had taken so many painful decades to cement my love for him forever? Once before, 100 years ago, he'd come stumbling into the Théâtre des Vampires on the trail of his renegade fledglings, sweet, gentle Louis and the doomed child. And I hadn't pitied him then, his skin scored with scars from Claudia's foolish and clumsy attempt to kill him. Loved him then, yes, I had, but this had been a bodily disaster which his evil blood would heal, and I knew from our old lore that in the healing he would gain even greater strength than serene time itself would have given him. But what I'd seen now was a devastation of the soul in his anguished face, and the vision of the one blue eye, shining so vividly in his streaked and wretched face, had been unbearable. I don't remember that we spoke, David. I remember only that the morning hastened us away, and if you cried too, I never heard you. I never thought to listen. As for the bundle he had carried in his arms, what could it have possibly been? I do not even think I thought of it. The next night, he came quietly into the parlor of the apartment as the darkness clambered down, starry for a few precious moments before the dreary descent of snow. He was washed and dressed, his torn and bleeding foot no doubt healed. He wore new shoes. But nothing could lessen the grotesque picture of his torn face, where the cuts of a claw or fingernails surrounded the gaping, puckering lids. Quietly, he sat down. He looked at me, and a faint, charming smile brightened his face. "Don't fear for me, little devil Armand," he said. "Fear for all of us. I am nothing now. I am nothing." In a low voice, I whispered to him my plan. "Let me go down into the streets. Let me steal from some mortal, some evil being who has wasted every physical gift that God ever gave, an eye for you. Let me put it here in the empty socket. Your blood will rush into it and make it see. You know, you saw this miracle once with the Ancient One, Maharet, indeed, with a pair of mortal eyes swimming in her special blood, eyes that could see. I'll do it. It won't take me but a moment, and then I'll have the eye in my hand and be the doctor myself and place it here. Please." He only shook his head. He kissed me quickly on the cheek. "Why do you love me after all I've done to you?" he asked. There was no denying the beauty of his smooth, poreless, sun-darkened skin, and even as the dark slit of the empty socket seemed to peer at me with some secret power to relay its vision to his heart, he was handsome and radiant, a darkish, ruddy glow coming from his face as though he'd seen some powerful mystery. "Yes, but I have," he said, and now began to cry. "I have, and I must tell you everything. Believe me as you believe what you saw last night, the wildflowers clinging still to my hair, the cuts. Look, my hands. They heal, but not fast enough. Believe me." "You intervened then, David. Tell us, Lestat. We would have waited here forever for you. Tell us. Where did this demon Memnoch take you?" "How comforting and reasonable your voice sounded, just as it does now. I think you were made for this, for reasoning, and given to us, if I may speculate, to force us to see our catastrophes in the new light of modern conscience. But we can talk of those things for many nights hereafter. Let me return to the scene. The three of us gathered in the black lacquered Chinese chairs around the thick glass table, and Dora coming in, at once struck by the presence of him, of which her mortal senses hadn't given her a clue. A pretty picture with her short, gleaming, knavish black hair, cut high to show the fragile nape of her swan-like neck, her long, supple body clad in a loose, sun-girdled gown of purple-red tissue that folded itself about her small breasts and slender thighs exquisitely. Ah, what an angel of the Lord this, I thought, musing, this heiress of the drug lord father's severed head. She teaches doctrines with every step that would make the pagan gods of lust canonize her with glee. About her pale, sweet throat, she wore a crucifix so tiny it seemed a gilded gnat suspended from a weightless chain of minuscule links woven by fairies. What are such holy objects now, tumbling on milky bosoms with such ease, but trinkets of the marketplace? My thoughts were merciless, but I was but an indifferent cataloguer of her beauty. Her swelling breasts, their shadowy cleft quite visible against the simple stitching of her dark, low-cut dress, told more of God and divinity. But her greatest adornment in these moments was the tearful and eager love for him, her lack of fear of his mutilated face, the grace of her white arms as she enclosed him again, so sure of herself and so grateful for the gentle yielding of his body in towards her. I was so thankful that she loved him. "So the Prince of Lies had a tale to tell, did he?" she asked. She could not kill the quaver in her voice. "So he's taken you to his hell and sent you back?" She took Lestat's face in her hands and turned it towards her. "Then tell us what it was, this hell. Tell us why we must be afraid. Tell us why you are afraid. But I think it's something far worse than fear that I see now in you." He nodded his head to say that it was. He pushed back the Chinese chair, and, wringing his hands, he began to pace, the inevitable prelude to his tale-telling. "Listen to all I say before you judge," he declared, fixing us now, the three who crowded about the table, an anxious little audience willing to do whatever he asked of us. "His eyes lingered on you, David, You, the English scholar in your manly tweed, who in spite of love, abundantly clear, beheld him with a critical eye, ready to evaluate his words with a wisdom natural to you. He began to talk. Hour by hour he talked. Hour by hour the words streamed out of him, heated and rushing, and sometimes tumbling over one another, so that he had to stop and catch his breath. But he never really paused as he poured it out over the long night, this tale of his adventure. Yes, Memnoc the devil had taken him to hell, but it was a hell of Memnoc's devising, a purgatorial place in which the souls of all who had ever lived were welcome to come of their own accord from the whirlwind of death which had inherited them. And in that purgatorial hell, confronted with all the deeds they'd ever done, they learnt the most hideous lesson of all, the endless consequences of every action ever committed by them. Murderer and mother alike, vagrant children slaughtered in seeming innocence, and soldiers bathed in blood from battlefields. All were admitted to this awful place of smoke and sulphurous fire, but only to see the gaping wounds in others made by their wrathful or unwitting hands, to plumb the depths of other souls and hearts which they had injured. All horror was an illusion in this place, but the worst horror of all was the person of God incarnate, who had allowed this final school for those who would be worthy to enter his paradise. And this, too, Lestat had seen, the heaven glimpsed a million times by saints and deathbed victims, of ever-blooming trees and flowers, eternally sweet, and endless crystal towers of happy, happy beings, shorn of all flesh, and one at last with countless choirs of singing angels. It was an old tale. It was too old. It had been told too many times, this tale, of heaven with her open gates, and God our Maker sending forth his endless light to those who climbed the mythic stairs to join the celestial court forever. How many mortals waking from a near-death sleep have struggled to describe these same wonders? How many saints have claimed to have glimpsed this indescribable and eternal Eden? And how cleverly this devil Memnoc had laid out his case to plead for mortal compassion for his sin, that he and he alone had opposed a merciless and indifferent God, to beg that deity to look down with compassionate eyes on a fleshly race of beings who had, by means of their own selfless love, managed to engender souls worthy of his interest. This, then, was the fall of Lucifer, like the star of morning from the sky, an angel begging for the sons and daughters of men, that they had now the countenances and hearts of angels. Give them paradise, Lord. Give it to them when they have learnt in my school how to love all that you have created. Oh, a book has been filled with this adventure. Memnoc the devil cannot be condensed here in these few unjust paragraphs. But this was the sum of what fell on my ears as I sat in this chilly New York room, gazing now and then past Lestat's frantic, pacing figure at the white sky of ever-falling snow, shutting out beneath his roaring narrative the rumble of the city far below, and struggling with the awful fear in myself that I must at the climax of his tale disappoint him, that I must remind him that he had done no more than shape the mystic journey of a thousand saints in a new and palatable fashion. So it is a school that replaces those rings of eternal fire which the poet Dante described in such degree as to sicken the reader, and even the tender Fra Angelico felt compelled to paint, where naked mortals bathed in flame were meant to suffer for eternity. A school, a place of hope, a promise of redemption, great enough perhaps to welcome even us, the children of the night, who counted murders among their sins as numerous as those of ancient Huns or Mongols. Oh, this was very sweet, this picture of the life hereafter, the horrors of the natural world laid off upon a wise but distant God, and the devil's folly rendered with such keen intelligence. Would that it were true! Would that all the poems and paintings of the world were but a mirror of such hopeful splendor! It might have saddened me. It might have broken me down to where I hung my head and couldn't look at him. But a single incident from his tale, one which to him had been a passing encounter, loomed large for me beyond all the rest, and locked itself to my thoughts, so that as he went on and on, I couldn't banish this from my mind, that he, Lestat, had drunk the very blood of Christ on the road to Calvary, that he, Lestat, had spoken to this God incarnate, who by his own will had walked towards this horrible death on Golgotha, that he, Lestat, a fearful and trembling witness, had been made to stand in the narrow dusty streets of ancient Jerusalem to see our Lord pass, and that this Lord, our living Lord, had, with the crossbeam of the crucifix strapped to his shoulders, offered his throat to Lestat, the chosen pupil. Ah, such fancy, this madness, such fancy! I had not expected to be so hurt by anything in this tale. I had not expected this to make a burning in my chest, a tightness in my throat from which no words could escape. I had not wanted this. The only salvation of my wounded heart was to think how quaint and foolish it was that such a tableau, Jerusalem, the dusty street, the angry crowds, the bleeding God, now scourged and limping beneath his wooden weight, should include a legend, old and sweet, of a woman with a veil, outstretched to wipe the bloody face of Christ in comfort, and thereby to receive for all time his image. It does not take a scholar, David, to know such saints were made by other saints in centuries to come, as actors and actresses chosen for a passion play in a country village. Veronica, Veronica, whose very name means true icon. And our hero, our Lestat, our Prometheus, with that veil given him by the very hand of God, had fled this great and ghastly realm of heaven and hell and the stations of the cross, crying, "No, and I will not," and come back breathless, running like a madman through the snows of New York, seeking only to be with us, turning his back on all of it. My head swam. There was a war inside of me. I couldn't look at him. On and on he went, going over it, talking again of the sapphic heavens and the angel's song, arguing with himself and with you and with Dora, and the conversation seemed like so much shattered glass. I couldn't bear it. The blood of Christ inside him, the blood of Christ passing his lips, his unclean lips, his undead lips, the blood of Christ making of him a monstrous ciborium, the blood of Christ? "Let me drink," I cried out suddenly. "Lestat, let me drink from you. Let me drink from your blood that has his blood inside it." I couldn't believe my own earnestness, my own wild desperation. "Lestat, let me drink. Let me look for the blood with my tongue and my heart. Let me drink, please. You can't deny me that one moment of intimacy. And if it was Christ, if it was..." I couldn't finish it. "Oh, mad and foolish child," he said. "All you'll know if you sink your teeth into me is what we learn from the visions we see with all our victims. You'll learn what I think I saw. You'll learn what I think was made known to me. You'll learn that my blood runs in my veins, which you know now. You'll learn that I believe it was Christ, but no more than that." He shook his head in disappointment as he glared at me. "No, I'll know," I said. I rose from the table, my hands quivering. "Lestat, give me this one embrace, and I'll never ask another thing of you for all eternity. Let me put my lips to your throat, Lestat. Let me test the tale. Let me do it." "You break my heart, you little fool," he said with tears welling. "You always did." "Don't judge me," I cried. He went on, speaking to me alone, from his mind as much as with his voice. I couldn't tell if anyone else there could even hear him, but I heard him. I would not forget a single word. "And what if it was the blood of God, Armand?" he asked, "and not part and parcel of some titanic lie. What would you find in me? Go out to the early morning mass and snatch your victims from those just come from the communion rail. What a pretty game that would be, Armand, to feed forever only on holy communicants. You can have your blood of Christ from any one of them. I tell you, I do not believe these spirits, God, Memnoch, these liars. I tell you, I refuse. I wouldn't stay. I fled their damned school. I lost my eye as I battled them. They snatched it from me, wicked angels clawing at me when I ran away from them. You want the blood of Christ? Then go down now in the dark church to the fisherman's mass, and knock the sleepy priest aside from the altar, if you will, and grab the chalice from his consecrated hands. Go ahead, do it." "Blood of Christ," he continued, his face one great eye fixing me in its merciless beam. "If it was ever in me, this sacred blood, then my body has dissolved it and burnt it up like candle wax devours the wick. You know this. What's left of Christ in the belly of his faithful when they leave the church?" "No," I said, "no, but we are not humans. I whispered, seeking somehow in softness to drown out his angry vehemence.
Lestat, I'll know. It was his blood, not transubstantiated bread and wine. His blood, Lestat, and I'll know if it's inside of you. Oh, let me drink, I beg you. Let me drink so I can forget every damned thing you've told us. Let me drink.
I could scarcely keep myself from laying hands on him, from forcing him to my will, never mind his legendary strength, his gruesome temper. I'd lay hold of him and make him submit. I'd take the blood. But these thoughts were foolish and vain. His whole tale was foolish and vain, and yet I turned around, and in a fury I spit the words at him.
Why didn't you accept? Why didn't you go with Memnoch if he could have taken you from this awful living hell we share? Why didn't you?
They let you escape, you said to him, David. You broke in, quieting me with a small, pleading gesture of your left hand. But I had no patience for analysis or inevitable interpretation. I couldn't get the image out of my mind. Our bloody lord, our lord with the cross beam bound to his shoulders, and she, Veronica, this sweet figment with the veil in her hands. Oh, how is it such a fantasy could get its hooks so deep? Back away from me, all of you, he cried. I have the veil. I told you, Christ gave it to me. Veronica gave it to me. I took it with me out of Memnoch's hell, when all his imps tried to take it from me. I scarcely heard. Veil? The actual veil? What trick is this? My head ached. The fisherman's mass. If there was such a thing in St. Patrick's below, I wanted to go there. I was weary of this glass-walled tower room, cut off from the taste of the wind and the wild, refreshing wetness of the snow. Why did Lestat back up against the wall? What did he take out of his coat? The veil. Some gaudy trick to seal this whole masterpiece of mayhem? I looked up, my eyes roaming over the snowy night beyond the glass, and only slowly finding their mark. The opened cloth which he held up in his hands, his own head bowed, the cloth revealed as reverently as it might have been by Veronica.
My lord, I whispered.
All the world was gone in curls of weightless sound and light. I saw him there.
My lord!
I saw his face, not painted, printed, or otherwise daintily tricked into the tiny fibers of the fine white cloth, but blazing with a flame that would not consume the vehicle that bore the heat of it. My lord the man, my lord, my Christ the man, with black and sharpened crown of thorns, and long twisted brown hair so fearfully clotted with blood, and great wondering dark eyes that stared straight at me, the sweet and vivid portals of the soul of God, so radiant their immeasurable love that all poetry dies before it, and a soft and silken mouth of unquestioning and unjudging simplicity, open to take a silent and agonizing breath at the very moment the veil had come to soothe this hideous suffering. I wept. I clamped my hand to my mouth, but I couldn't stop my words.
Oh, Christ, my tragic Christ,
I whispered.
Not made by human hands, I cried out. Not made by human hands.
How wretched my words, how feeble, how filled with sorrow.
This man's face, this face of God and man, he bleeds. For the love of Almighty God, look at it.
But not a sound had come from me. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I'd fallen down on my knees in my shock and in my helplessness. I never wanted to take my eyes from it. I never wanted anything any more again, ever. I wanted only to look at it. I wanted only to look at him, and I saw him, and I saw back over the centuries, back to his face in the light of the earthen lamp burning in the house in Poddle, his face gazing at me from the panel between my quivering fingers amid the candles of the scriptorium of the Monastery of the Caves, his face as I had never seen it on those glorious walls of Venice or Florence, where I had for so long and so desperately sought it. His face, his manly face infused with the divine, my tragic lord gazing at me from my mother's arms in the frozen sludge of the long-ago street of Poddle, my loving lord in bloody majesty. I didn't care what Dora said. I didn't care that she screamed his holy name. I didn't care. I knew. And as she declared her faith, as she snatched the veil from Lestat's very hands and ran with it out of this apartment, I followed, moving after her and after the veil,
though in the sanctuary of my heart I never moved. I never stirred. A great stillness had overtaken my mind, and my limbs no longer mattered. It did not matter that Lestat fought with her, and cautioned her that she must not believe this thing, and that the three of us stood on the steps of the cathedral, and that the snow fell like some splendid blessing from the invisible and fathomless heavens. It did not matter that the sun was soon to rise, a fiery silver ball beyond the canopy of melting clouds. I could die now. I had seen him, and all the rest, the words of Memnoch and his fanciful god, the pleas of Lestat that we come away, that we hide ourselves before the morning devoured us all. It did not matter. I could die now. "Not made by human hands," I whispered. A crowd gathered around us at the doors. The warm air came out of the church in a deep, delicious gust. It didn't matter. "The veil, the veil," they cried. They saw his face. Lestat's desperate, imploring cries were dying away. The morning came down in its thunderous, white-hot light, rolling over roofs and curdling the night in a thousand glassy walls, and slowly unleashing its monstrous glory. "Bear witness," I said. I held up my open arms to the blinding light, this molten, silvery death. "This sinner dies for him. This sinner goes to him. Cast me into hell, O Lord, if that is your will. You have given me heaven. You have shown me your face. And your face was human." Chapter 19. I shot upwards. The pain I felt was total, scalding away all will or power to choose momentum. An explosion inside me sent me skyward, right into the pearly, snowy light which had come in a sudden flood, as it always does, from a threatening eye one moment, sending its endless rays over the cityscape to a tidal wave of weightless, molten illumination, rolling over all things great and small. Higher and higher I went, spinning as if the force of the interior explosion would not stop its intensity, and in my horror I saw that my clothes had been burnt away, and a smoke veered off my limbs into the whirling wind. I caught one full glimpse of my limbs, my naked outstretched arms and splayed legs, silhouetted against the obliterating light. My flesh was burnt black already, shiny, sealed to the sinews of my body, collapsed to the intricate tangle of muscles which encased my bones. The pain reached the zenith of what I could bear. But how can I explain that it didn't matter to me? I was on the way to my own death, and this seemingly endless torture was nothing, nothing. I could endure all things, even the burning in the eyes, the knowledge that they would soon melt or explode in this furnace of sunlight, and that all that I was would pass out of flesh. Abruptly the scene changed. The roar of the wind was gone. My eyes were quiet and focused, and all around there arose a great familiar chorus of hymns. I stood at an altar, and as I looked up I beheld a church before me thronged with people, its painted columns rising like so many ornate tree trunks out of the wilderness of singing mouths and wondering eyes. Everywhere, to right and to left, I saw this immense and endless congregation. The church had no walls to bind it, and even the rising domes, decorated in the purest and most glittering gold with the hammered saints and angels, gave way to the great, ever-thinning and never-ending blue sky. Incense filled my nostrils. Around me the tiny golden bells rang in unison, and with one riff of delicate melody tumbling fast upon another. The smoke burnt my eyes, but so sweetly, as the fragrance of the incense filled my nostrils and made my eyes water, and my vision become one with all I tasted and touched and heard. I threw out my arms, and I saw long, golden-trimmed white sleeves covering them, falling back from wrists which were covered with the soft, fleecy down of a man's natural hair. These were my hands, yes, but my hands years past the mortal point where life had been fixed in me. They were the hands of a man. Out of my mouth there came a song, echoing loudly and singly over the congregation, and then their voices rose in answer, and once again I intoned my conviction, the conviction that had overcome me to the marrow of my bones. Christ is come. The incarnation is begun in all things and in all men and women, and will go on forever. It seemed a song of such perfection that the tears flowed from me, and as I bowed my head and clasped my hands, I looked down to see the bread and the wine in front of me, the rounded loaf waiting to be blessed and broken, and the wine in the golden chalice there to be transformed. This is the body of Christ, and this is blood shed for us now and before and forever, and in every moment of which we are alive. I sang out. I laid my hands on the loaf and lifted it, and a great stream of light poured forth out of it, and the congregation gave forth their sweetest, loudest hymn of praise. In my hands I held the chalice. I held it high as the bells pealed from the towers, towers and towers that crowded near the towers of this grand church, stretching for miles in all directions, the whole world having become this great and glorious wilderness of churches, and here beside me the little golden bells chimed. Once again came the gusts of incense. Setting down the chalice, I looked at the sea of faces stretching before me. I turned my head from left to right, and then I looked heavenward at the disappearing mosaics, which became one with the rising, roiling white clouds. I saw gold domes beneath heaven. I saw the endless rooftops of Podol. I knew it was Vladimir's city in all its glory, and that I stood in the great sanctuary of Santa Sofia, all screens having been taken away that would have divided me from the people, and all those other churches which had been but ruins in my long-ago dim childhood were now restored to magnificence, and the golden domes of Kiev drank the light of the sun and gave it back with the power of a million planets basking eternal in the fire of a million stars. "My Lord, my God!" I cried out. I looked down at the embroidered splendor of my vestments, the green satin and its threads of pure metallic gold. On either side of me stood my brothers in Christ, bearded, eyes glowing as they assisted me, as they sang the hymns which I sang, as our voices mingled, pressing on from anthem to anthem, in notes that I could almost see rising before me to the airy firmament above. "Give it to them, give it to them, because they are hungry," I cried. I broke the loaf of bread in my hands. I broke it into halves, and then into quarters, and tore these hastily into small morsels, which crowded the shining golden plate. En masse, the congregation mounted the steps, tender pink little hands reaching for the morsels, which I gave out as fast as I could, morsel after morsel, not a crumb spilling, the bread divided among dozens, and then scores, and then hundreds, as they pressed forward, the newcomers barely allowing those who had been fed to make their way back. On and on they came, but the hymns did not cease. Voices, muted at the altar, silenced as the bread was devoured, soon burst forth loud and jubilant again. The bread was eternal. I tore its soft, thick crust again and again, and put it into the outstretched palms, the gracefully cupped fingers. "Take it, take the body of Christ," I said. Dark, wavering, shadowy forms rose around me, rising up out of the gleaming gold and silver floor. They were trunks of trees, and their limbs arched upward and then down towards me, and leaves and berries fell from these branches, down onto the altar, onto the golden plate, and onto the sacred bread, now in a great mass of fragments. "Gather them up," I cried. I picked up the soft green leaves and the fragrant acorns, and I gave these too to the eager hands. I looked down, and I saw grain pouring through my fingers, grain which I offered to opened lips, grain which I poured into open mouths. The air was thick with the soundless falling of the green leaves, so much so that the soft, brilliant shade of green tinted all around it, broken suddenly everywhere by the flight of tiny birds. A million sparrows flushed heavenward. A million finches soared, the brilliant sun flitting on their tiny, outstretched wings. "Forever, ongoing, always in every cell and every atom," I prayed. "The incarnation," I said, "and the Lord has dwelt among us." My words rang out again as if a roof covered us, a roof that could echo my song, though our roof was now the roofless sky alone. The crowd pressed in. They surrounded the altar. My brothers had slipped away, thousands of hands tugging gently at their vestments, pulling them back from the table of God. All around me there pressed these hungry ones, who took the bread as I gave it, who took the grain, who took the acorns by the handful, who took even the tender green leaves. There stood my mother beside me, my beautiful and sad-faced mother, a fine embroidered headdress gracing her thick gray hair, with her wrinkled little eyes fastened on me. And in her trembling hands, her dried and fearful fingers, she held the most splendid of offerings, the painted eggs, red and blue and yellow and golden, and decorated with bands of diamonds and chains of the flowers of the field. The eggs shimmered in their lacquered splendor as if they were giant polished jewels. And there in the very center of her offering, this offering which she held up with shivering, wrinkled arms, there lay the very egg which she had once so long ago entrusted to me, the light, raw egg so gorgeously decorated in brilliant ruby red, with the star of gold in the very center of the framed oval, this precious egg which had surely been her finest creation, the finest achievement of her hours with the burning wax and boiling dye. It wasn't lost. It had never been lost. It was there. But something was happening. I could hear it. Even under the great swelling song of the multitudes, I could hear it. The tiny sound inside the egg. The tiny fluttering sound. The tiny cry. "Mother," I said. I took it. I held it in both hands and brought my thumbs down against the brittle shell. "No, my son," she cried. She wailed. "No, no, my son, no." But it was too late. The lacquered shell was smashed beneath my thumbs, and out of its fragments had risen a bird, a beautiful and full-grown bird, a bird of snow-white wings and tiny yellow beak and brilliant black eyes like bits of jet. A long, full sigh came out of me. Out of the egg it rose, unfolding its perfectly feathered white wings, its tiny beak open in a sudden, shrill cry. Up it flew, this bird, freed of the broken red shell, up and up, over the heads of the congregation, and up through the soft, swirling rain of the green leaves and fluttering sparrows, up through the glorious clamor of the pealing bells it flew. The bells of the towers rang out so loud that they shook the swirling leaves in the atmosphere, so loud that the soaring columns quivered, that the crowd rocked and sang all the more heartily, as if to be in perfect unison with the great resounding golden-throated peals. The bird was gone. The bird was free. "Christ is born," I whispered. "Christ is risen. Christ is in heaven and on earth. Christ is with us." But no one could hear my voice, my private voice. And what did it matter, for all the world sung the same song? A hand clutched me. Rudely, meanly, it tore at my white sleeve. I turned. I drew in my breath to scream and froze in terror. A man, come out of nowhere, stood beside me.